Welcome to the Neuroscience of Change, a free series created by Coaches Rising. This series explores the burgeoning field of neuroscience and how you can harness the exciting discoveries made in this field in order to become a more effective coach. The series features teaching sessions with thought leaders and world-class coaches, all with years of experience applying these discoveries when working with clients. And they're going to share the wisdom of what they learned with you. Once you've registered at coachesrising.com/landing/neuroscience of change, all the dialogues are available and free to download.
Hello everybody, a warm welcome. It's Joel here, and today I am joined on the line by Amanda Blake. How are you doing, Amanda?
Very well, thank you, Joel.
Excellent. Just give us a sense of your location today. Where are you tuning in from?
I am in California in the Sierra Nevada mountains. I live in the Lake Tahoe area.
Beautiful. Excellent. So I'm looking forward to diving in with you in the next 50 minutes or so and exploring how neuroscience can impact the way we work with our clients. I'll just say a few more words about you. Amanda is a certified master somatic coach from the Strozzi Institute, and she's the founder of Embright, which is a coaching and coach training organization. You can find them online. We'll give you the website details a bit later. And she's working with people in seminars and private consultation to help them embody a more compelling presence and align their actions with their deeply felt cares and handle high-pressure situations with more equanimity to develop more satisfying and effective relationships with others. And I'm a big fan of her work, so I'm super excited that she's going to be speaking today. And I can also recommend her six-month training, Body Equals Brain. I'm sure she'll say more about that. So, let's dive in, Amanda. I wanted to ask first, well, let's just start with asking, what are the latest discoveries in the field of neuroscience telling us about how human beings grow?
Well, I think, I think the biggest, most important message is that really deep change and the capacity to build new behaviors or take new actions that we maybe haven't been able to take before is far more possible than ever previously believed. It used to be that neuroscientists and psychologists alike thought that the kinds of emotional learnings that we take on early in our life that maybe later in life trip us up, and these could be things like, I shrink in the face of conflict, or I get really aggressive in the face of conflict, or I have a hard time speaking up for what I believe in. This is the way that some of these, what are called implicit emotional memories, can show up in our lives. And for a long time, psychologists and neuroscientists have thought that those, unfortunately, are just unchangeable. They get wired into our brain, and we're stuck with them, but what we can do is learn new ways of acting, but we kind of have to stay a little bit vigilant to kind of stay on top of some of those old habits or ways of being. And it turns out that very recent research in the last 10 years or so is putting the lie to that, which is really, really exciting. And for any coaches or psychologists or educators who work really experientially, who work really with embodied practices or active practices that help people experience learning as opposed to kind of taking on new information, that all of that has a really, really powerful capacity to create deep change and to create change at a neurological level. So this has been studied in the lab, not just with humans, but with a whole variety of animals, rats, snails, nematodes, you name it. And there's a process that involves that's a very experiential process that can actually erase old implicit emotional learning at the level of the neurons, literally at a cellular level. And it can result in behavioral changes that feel really effortless to maintain and that are durable over time. And I just think that's really, really, really exciting news for any of us who have ever had something in our lives where we feel like, wow, I really know how to change this. I really know how I want to be different here. And I've read all the books about it, and I understand it, and somehow I'm still not doing it. Somehow I'm still getting tripped up. And so it turns out with proper methodology, there are some newly developing ways to create those kinds of lasting changes. I think it's really exciting.
So I've heard you say experience a number of times, so I get that this is not just about talking about something. Maybe it includes that, but some kind of practice or experience is really essential.
Absolutely. I think talking can help us come to new insight, new awareness, can help us see things in new ways and gain new perspectives. And I think that's a really, really important part of learning and change and growth. And, sometimes there are these stubborn, stuck places where all the talk in the world won't seem to make a dent. And I remember years ago, I had a coaching client that I was working with, and she yearned for spending more time with her son. She was a single mother who had a 10-year-old son, and she ran a business. And what she found is that in every instance where her business was calling her attention, she would turn to that and spend time there rather than spending time with her son. And it was breaking her heart, and we talked and talked and talked about it. And I just absolutely couldn't help her make the changes in her behavior and her actions that she so deeply longed to make. And this was hard for me as a coach because I felt like, wow, what am I doing here? I'm completely incompetent. And that wasn't necessarily true at all, but I wasn't playing with a full deck, you could say. I didn't have a full quiver of arrows. And the arrows that I had, the tools that I had, just weren't sufficient for the task in her case. And I had experienced similar things in my own life where I got stuck and tripped up, and even though I knew everything to do, couldn't seem to make change. What finally made a difference for me, both in my own life where I was stuck and as a coach, was entering into a more experiential process of coaching that really puts people in a present moment experience of whatever it is that's getting them stuck or tripped up, and helps them in that moment make a shift to a new way of seeing or being or experiencing themselves. And what happens when you work this way, and it typically in one way or another is going to involve some sort of action or movement or engagement of the physical body. So what typically happens when you engage in this experiential way is that you're engaging more of the whole self, more of one's full intelligence, and it starts to open the door to, like I said, makes a more durable change available. Now, there are some specific steps and procedures that that kind of help, what do I want to say here, that will foster that happening. So it's very possible for us to stumble upon it by accident. And I would argue that anywhere where we're making really durable, lasting change, we've probably stumbled on these particular steps by accident. And that's great. And we can also pull out some meta principles and be able to go, well, here are the main things that really need to be present in order for that kind of change to take place.
Wow. And I can feel the excitement in me of wanting to explore and unpack that process of helping people make change. But I'm wondering if you could perhaps first talk a bit about how we develop as human beings in the first place. Maybe you can unpack that process. It can help us get a deeper cut on this, you know, this path of helping then people make shifts in their lives.
Well,
and maybe you can explore some of the physiological or neurological components of that too.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to do that. And I think I'm glad you asked, because I believe that understanding that is really key to understanding how we change and learn and grow in adulthood. Because the process of original behavioral learning is very, very much a biological process. So there are a couple of different aspects of that to understand. One is that when you're born, your brain is the least differentiated of all of your organs. What that means is that, you know, like your heart when you're born, it's basically the same heart that you're going to have when you're 25. It's just smaller. But your brain, when you're born, it looks really, really different from how it's going to look at 25. And that's by design. You know, nature was really smart about this. And the design is for your brain and your entire nervous system, which is distributed throughout your whole body. So your brain really, you can think about your brain as encompassing or being a part of your whole body. And your brain takes shape in response to the environment that it's in. It physically takes shape in response to the relationships you have, to the activities that you take on, in response to the cultural norms that you live in. A classic example of this is that men and boys are given a message in many cultures that it's not okay to cry. And in order not to cry, you have to actually take some physical action to not do that. So if you have a sadness welling up inside you and you want to hold that emotion in, I can actually feel my shoulders raising as I'm speaking about this. You'll hold your breath a little bit. You'll squeeze your eyes a little bit. You might clench your jaw, right? There are a number of physical, muscular actions that you take in order to modulate your emotion to the society that you live in, to the family that you live in, to the world that you live in. And your brain learns how to do this, but when I say brain, I really want to encourage everyone on the call to not just think about what happens between your ears, but actually what happens down your spine and around your ribs and out to your fingers and toes. Because what's happening is your brain is picking up patterns from your environment. One of the things that the brain does, it's a pattern detection instrument, and it takes on those patterns that are smart, that work to help us get the things that we most need in life, and then it puts those patterns on autopilot. And a lot of what we most need in life is relational and rooted in emotion. In fact, the brain, if you look at the evolution of the brain over time, is, we can say it evolved to be our social and emotional sense organ. And there's a lot of biology behind that. But what you see when you look at the evolutionary pressures that had different aspects, different parts and pieces of the brain develop, you may have heard of the reptilian brain or the limbic brain or the emotional brain. Those are two terms that are sometimes used interchangeably. These different aspects of the brain developed in response to different evolutionary pressures, like the need to keep ourselves safe, physically safe from harm, or the need to, in the case of mammals, communicate with our caregiver what we actually need. I'm hungry now, or I need warmth, right? And all of that happens through in species that don't have language or don't have so much language, don't have so much vocalization. It happens through emotional kinds of communication. And our brain actually has different density depending on the size of the social group that we live in. So that's species by species. So we can look at dogs and see that their brains have more neural density than cats. And dogs are more social than cats. And one of the reasons biologists think this neural density arose in more social animals is to help us navigate our social environment. So if you take all that and you think, okay, so the brain evolves to be our social and emotional sense organ. And it's distributed throughout the entire body. And it learns and takes shape, literally takes physical shape at a cellular level. There are structural and chemical changes that happen when we learn. So we're taking physical shape in response to our social and emotional environment that we live in. So we take on these behaviors, and you have to remember that your brain, your nerves don't end in a vacuum, right? This is all telling the muscles what to do. It's all a very coordinated, complete system. And so what happens is we'll take on certain behaviors, like I was saying before. I shrink in the face of conflict, or I get really aggressive in the face of conflict, or I'm very indecisive about what's my next best move in life, or I'm very decisive. And I move into things very, very quickly, and sometimes that's what trips you up, right? But these qualities that make us uniquely who we are, they're actually embodied qualities. And they go along with certain muscular contractions or actions or movements, like squeezing down tears or squelching laughter or holding your voice in if you're somebody who feels uncomfortable sharing your ideas with the world. All of that has a muscular component to it. And so our behavioral learning is actually deeply, deeply biological. And when I talk about, you know, later in life when we come to want to make change, if we're going to be most successful doing that, we really need to incorporate or follow, I guess I would say, the original process by which we learned behaviors in the first place. We go, okay, here's the way the brain learns. Here's the way the brain and body learn our behavioral habits or patterns. And if we're going to change, that means we would do well or be well advised to follow that original process of learning. And if we're going to do that, that means let's incorporate the body into the process of behavior change.
What a rich answer. What a beautiful answer. And I'm wondering if you could unpack a bit more, you know, the implications that what you've shared, what it comes to when working skillfully with your clients and this kind of working with the body. Could you unpack that a little bit more? How might we approach making change in that way?
Yeah. There are a number of different things that support change and learning. And if you look across, I'm just thinking about what pieces of the answer do I want to give you here to that question. This is how I think I'll talk about it. If you look at the original process of learning, there are a number of things that are involved in that original process that we want to include or emulate in any kind of adult change. So let me just name those, but there's one in particular that's really important in adult change that doesn't happen in our original process of learning, and I'd like to focus mostly on that one. So I'll list the six things that really foster and facilitate neuroplasticity. The first of those is relationship. So we do all our original learning in relationship with others. Our brains take shape in relationship with others. I think you have Dan Siegel in this program as well, who is does fantastic work in interpersonal neurobiology and how we affect and shape one another's brain, particularly in our early learning. So it's really important for any process of change that we be in relationship with others, and that may be one-on-one or that may be in a learning community. And what's really important there is that you're related in relationship with someone whose way of being you would want or choose to emulate. That's one of the things. A second thing is emotional engagement. So it's really, you know, as coaches, we're often trained, many coaching modalities teach us to ask our clients, why is that important to you, or what's important about that? The brain only learns when something is important or meaningful to the organism. And that's true across species. It needs to matter. And so emotional engagement is really, really important. And the brain learns also much more quickly and much more durably when we're emotionally engaged. Neurotransmitters like dopamine, in the case of joy or pleasure, and norepinephrine in the case of stress or fear, will flood the brain. And when those neurotransmitters flood the brain, the learning gets locked in more completely. So, I mentioned that there are structural and chemical or physical changes to neurons when we learn. And when that process of learning is happening in the presence of these chemicals, the process of learning, those structural and chemical changes are much stronger and more durable. So whatever happens there that we're learning that we care about, it's wired in more deeply. So emotional engagement is really, really important. The third thing is awareness. Richard Davidson in his lab at the University of Wisconsin has done a lot of studies on how attention and awareness can actually change the physical structure of the brain. In other words, what we pay attention to actually changes our brain in the same way that the muscles we use will change our muscles, right? If you go on a hike every day, you'll have very strong legs. Whereas if you are doing push-ups every day, your arms will change in response to that action. Our brains will change in response to how we exercise our attention. So, so the third thing is attention or awareness. The fourth thing that we need is movement. So our brain is, and our perception of the world is shaped by the way we move. And there's a whole field of study called embodied cognition that finds things like right-handers see right-word images or ideas on a page as better than those on the left, for example. And this is reflected in our language. There are many more right-handers than left-handers. And if you look at the meaning of words like right on or we have rights, versus the meaning of words that are associated with left, which tend to be, in French, gauche, right, which means sort of not so awesome. I don't have a good translation of that word. Or left behind or left out, right? Well, the way our habitual repeated movements actually shape the way we perceive the world. And there's great research done by Amy Cuddy with her team at Harvard about how standing in a powerful posture for as little as 90 seconds actually makes changes not only in our own internal sense of agency, but also in our hormones, also in the actions that we take, our willingness to take calculated risks, and in how others perceive us. So movement and action actually changes how we perceive the world, and that's another important component of learning and change. The fifth thing is practice. And practice is really important because the brain learns through repetition over time. But there's an important caveat here, and it goes back to emotional engagement, which I think I talked about a second, which is that repetition in and of itself actually doesn't do very much at all. And the classic example of this is writing I will not speak during class on the chalkboard 100 times, right? Or on a piece of paper, as teachers used to make kids do. Maybe they still make them do that. I don't know. If you don't care, if you are not emotionally engaged in that repetition, it will make no difference. It will make no change. No learning will no substantial learning will take place. So practice is really important in repetition over time. And all of those five things are elements of how we learn in the first place. But there's a sixth thing that's really, really important in adult learning and change. And that is, you could use many names for it. I usually call it disruption. But you could call it unlearning, or you could call it interrupting what is. But what happens is once we're in adulthood, part of what happens is early in life we kind of take on particular behaviors and ways of being. And then when we get to adulthood, those are already embodied in us. Those are already physically wired in. It's what pops out of us automatically. It's what comes to us most naturally or by default, even sometimes when we don't want it to. And so there has to be this process in adult learning of interruption, of disruption, of unlearning the old way of being. And that's a really, really important addition to kind of follow this process of like following the original process of learning. So if you like, Joel, we can talk a little bit more about disruption and how to engage that and where to go with that. But I want to just pause here and see if you have other questions or want to go in another direction or how we're doing on time, all that.
Oh, great. Yeah, I would love to follow this direction. I think what comes to mind is, you know, those moments where I've worked with clients and kind of pointed out in the moment, you know, when they are kind of in a certain way of being that they're not seeing. You know, it's like they're a fish in the water, and then they kind of literally have those like matrix moments where they pop out and see that they're doing that thing. So I love what you're talking about with this. So please go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you mention that, it makes me think about, you know, what I said about attention, which is one of the things that's really important to the process of disruption, and all of these six things interplay against one another. So it's helpful to pull them out and talk about them as separate pieces, but they're all kind of interdependent. The process of disruption or unlearning requires us to be able to catch ourselves in the act, in a sense. And often what happens in life is when we have some behavior that we've embodied. So let's take the example of somebody who's having a hard time speaking up in meetings, for example. And they know they have good ideas, and this person really wants a promotion, or they really want to go to the next level in their career, but they feel held back by the fact that they kind of, you know, when it gets into a meeting, they sort of question themselves and aren't sure. And by the time they get up the courage to speak, the moment has passed. Okay, so let's say that's going on. In our everyday lives, this person, I want to think of the names for this person, Jonathan, let's say. So this person, Jonathan, who's having a hard time sharing his good ideas, in his everyday life, what's likely to happen is he will be able to notice after the fact that, oh my God, yet again, I did it on Monday, and here it is Wednesday, and yet again, I had a really good idea, and I didn't speak up and say it, and Steve or Mary or Joanne spoke up and shared an idea very similar to mine, and everyone was very receptive to it, and yet somehow I didn't come out with the idea, and I'm not ever going to get my work recognized if I don't say what it is I have to say. So what's often the case is that we'll catch ourselves after the fact, and we'll have these regrets, or we'll kick ourselves, and regretfully, painfully, we beat ourselves up for it. We feel frustrated or like there's something wrong with us. And really, there's nothing wrong with us. There's nothing wrong with Jonathan. The only thing is that he learned a particular way of being, of not speaking up, that at some point in time served him. And the reason we know for sure that at some point in time it was useful is because the brain never would have learned it if it wasn't useful. The brain only learns what is useful and valuable to the organism as it's true across species. So it was useful at one time. So we can cut ourselves a break. And I think, well, here's where I want to go with this. So we will commonly catch ourselves after the fact and beat ourselves up for it. The piece about attention is that if we can start to pay attention in those moments where that we're actually doing that behavior, or as my wonderful friend Dr. Fitz Johnson says, catch ourselves being ourselves. We can catch ourselves being ourselves in the moment, which is a process of focusing our attention in a particular way on what we're doing, then we can start to open a space where we can change that behavior. But if we can't catch it in the moment, if we can't see it in action, if we don't see it happening but we only see it after the fact, then it gets very challenging for us to do anything about it or to make any choice about it. So bringing that to our awareness and our attention is the first step. And one of the most powerful ways to do that is to help people get an experience, so back to the experiential piece, help people get an experience, a felt sense in their body of what it's like to not speak up. What is it like for Jonathan when he's not speaking up? And in terms of, like, in a coaching relationship, you can do that right in the coaching conversation and invite him into a moment to remember a moment. Okay, what was it like the last time you did this behavior, or the last time you didn't speak up? And really get the experience of it. Like, what were the sensations that went along with that? What was the experience of that? Because when we move our attention to the in-the-moment experience, the in-the-moment sensory experience, that's actually something that is very tangible, that's very easy to remember, and that then when it arises again, it's easier for us to catch it in the moment. So this is the first step, is kind of paying attention, developing awareness. I want to pause here, Joel, and see if you have a question or if I'm on track in answering your question or if you want to direct me in another way. There's some next steps in other directions you can take. But.
Yeah, I'm loving the way you're unpacking this and taking us into this, on a granular level. So I'm getting the sense, it's not just about the body. It's this kind of whole, the emotion, sensation, thinking, all combined. So, I'd just love you to carry on unpacking this.
Great. Good. Okay, so that, what you just said there, I do want to point to and emphasize. It's definitely not just about the body. What we're paying attention to in catching ourselves being ourselves is the whole of our experience. Which means, what are the sensations that are happening? What is the bodily experience? And the sensations are valuable to pay attention to because sensation only happens in the present moment. It's actually not happening a few moments ago or a few moments from now. It's happening right now, and it can bring us very immediately into the present. So that helps us catch ourselves being ourselves. And then in that moment, what we also want to be paying attention to is how does it feel emotionally to be having this experience? What's my perspective on the world or my narrative or my story? What assumptions are present or what interpretations are present? So this is more abstract and thinking self, but what's present for me right now as I'm catching myself, being myself in terms of like my view of the world? So looking at all of those dimensions at once and getting really granular about what's happening in this moment, this catching yourself, being yourself moment. And then when you understand that, the next step in the direction of disruption is to understand, to have a conversation with your client about, why was this a really good idea? How did this develop? And you don't need to go into the long history of it or any kind of therapeutic diagnosis, but just like, why was this smart? Why was this a good idea? What about this was intelligence? Because we know that we only really embody qualities, again, the brain only learns patterns that are helpful for the organism. And I keep saying that in a very biological term because it's a biological, I'm tempted to say fact or truth, but it's something that biologists understand about how the nervous system works, right? The brain only learns things that are important to the organism. So we know that this was important at one time. So why was it smart? Why was it a good idea? And when you get that understanding with your client, one of the things that can really help produce is a lot of self-compassion. We can cut ourselves a break. Oh, maybe I don't have to beat myself up about this so hard. Maybe I don't have to be quite so hard on myself about this. And I think that's really, really a beautiful thing for many reasons. One is, oh, what a sigh of relief. Like, so much easier on our hearts to be kind to ourselves. It really is. The other is that when we are at war with something, when we are resisting something in our own internal experience, when we are pushing against something, in a sense, it's going to push right back at us. It locks that thing in place. And, you know, that adage, what you resist persists. It's, you know, when you're really fighting against something, even if it's something in your psyche or in your body, and you're making it wrong and bad, it's very difficult for that thing to actually dissolve and let go. But when you can see that thing and hold it with some compassion and care and understanding, even if it's a quality inside yourself, it actually lets go much more easily. So why was it smart? And then the next step is to look for what's something in your client's life that's really alive and true for them that is a substitute or a mismatch or disconfirming evidence for the thing that they're stuck with. So in Jonathan's case, this might be something like, you know, wow, I realize that one of the reasons that I don't speak up is because I feel like I didn't graduate from college, and I feel like I don't actually have sufficient training. I don't actually have sufficient voice, right? And I don't have permission or legitimacy here. What he can also realize after, you know, doing some coaching around this is, well, it turns out that in the company that I work in, this woman who speaks up all the time and that gets a lot of the credit, in this company that I work in, she comes from an entirely different industry. I mean, she has a college degree, but she comes from an entirely different industry. And so she's pretty new to the company. So how is it that I think that her ideas are legitimate when I have, you know, 20 years in this industry? I may not have gone to college, but I actually have a lot more experience here than she does. So you're looking for something that's alive and true in the person's life and helping them have an experience of what it's like to recognize, oh, there's also something else that's true that disconfirms my original belief. How can I have an experience of that as well? And then in this process of disruption, all of this is preparatory coaching. The part that's been recently studied in the lab that I mentioned way at the beginning of the call is this next part, which has been shown to literally dissolve at a cellular level the old mental model, the old schema, the old view or understanding of the world that's holding all of this in place. And the way to do that shift is to activate the original stuck spot. You get an experience of the original stuck spot. Okay, so Jonathan, imagine yourself in that meeting. And imagine yourself not speaking up. And what happens? Well, my throat gets tight and my eyes get tight and I'm tapping my pen on the table really fast. And I notice I'm not breathing a lot and I feel both anxious and like a sense of disappointment in myself. Okay, and so Jonathan is having this experience in his body. And meanwhile, together you've identified this substitute, this mismatch, this disconfirming information. And his experience of recognizing that this other person, I'll call her Joanna, is comfortable speaking up, even though she also doesn't necessarily have the official credential. And that doesn't piss off everyone around him, that they accept her ideas and are grateful for the contribution. Like, that experience actually makes him feel, oh, like a little, his shoulders go back a little bit, his chin lifts. He has a little bit more of a sense of hope inside. And so your job as the coach in this process of disruption is to help him have an experience of the old stuck place and an experience of the new view or the substituting view simultaneously, or one right after the other. And then to practice that over time, to do that repeatedly. This experiential process of change, this simultaneous activation of a stuck place and another different unstuck way of being is what has been shown to actually make durable change that is effortless to maintain, that has no further emotional charge on it. Really, really powerful stuff. And, well, let me stop there, Joel, and see what's next.
Beautiful. I mean, I'm just loving what you're talking about here. And I'm wondering, like, could you say a few more words about, you know, how we can... So I'm imagining a coach is sat there and they're working with a client and they're helping their client, you know, to experience this old way where they feel stuck and they've got that, you know, they're building that kind of map of it experientially in the moment. And then you disrupt that, you know, by bringing in this new, more creative or larger way of being. And like, how does a coach go helping their client do that? And you know, how do they identify that new way of operating that to bring in? And what's that like when a client starts to experience that in this, you know, this, the totality of their experience?
Yeah.
Big question.
How long do you have? How long do you have? That's the art. Okay, that is totally the art of it. Like, how do you identify, well, what's an appropriate substituting response and help a client through that experience? That's the art of it. And it's not, you know, it's not something that I can offer in a one-hour phone call, but what I would say is what can be helpful in this moment? It's a it's a process of discovering the client's own resourcefulness. We can really trust that somewhere in the client's life, they are already well-resourced. They're already, they already have some strength or capacity. And what you're really looking for is, where is the strength or capacity that they have that is, in a sense, the best mismatch, the most directly disconfirming of the place where they're stuck. So, for example, one of the things you can do, and this is a really easy kind of, I'll give you two shortcuts to finding a substitute. One is, if you know a particular centering process that's experiential, that's not just involving your attention, but that's also involving your body and movement in some way, then I think that's always a fabulous shortcut. If you don't have something like that, one of the things that you can do is to ask someone, what are you like at your best? Or to look for a what are you like at your best that's very specific to this kind of situation. So if we take the Jonathan example and say, well, are there any places in your life where you do have an easy time speaking up? Well, yeah, with my wife. You know, I have no problems. And I really enjoy sharing my ideas with her. You know, okay, so that's a whole different set of circumstances, but what you can look at is, what is the constellation of body and emotion and narrative or perspective that gets initiated or activated when he's speaking with his wife? Oh, well, how does that feel in my body? Well, I'm in a different posture, right? I'm usually leaning in a bit, and instead of tapping my pencil on the table, I feel really calm and relaxed. And I feel a sense of connection, and the way I know that is I feel like this warmth in my belly, right? So all of this is like, you have to practice to know where to look. As a coach, you really have to have practice in this approach or this methodology. But what you're really looking for is, where is there a live experience in this person's life that is that helps them be most resourced or most at their best? And it's best if it's sort of directly disconfirming of the original stuck place. And then you want them to have that experience of being stuck and being at their best repeatedly, simultaneously, one right after the other. And they can do that in their session with you, and then go out and do that in the world. And that can be really helpful for people. So there are actually a couple things that come to mind for me here, Joel, that I might want to share that would be helpful for people. So one idea is a practice that I can do on the phone right now that helps people get a feel for this kinder approach to change. And the other is, I would be really happy to offer, I have something called the Stress to Serenity Guide that's available on my website, that's a 7-day centering challenge. And for people who are looking for what's a way that I can, where can I find a substitute? This Stress to Serenity Challenge, this centering practice that I teach in this program is a sort of universal possible substitute. It can be used in almost any situation, and it's very experiential. So I'd be happy for people to have that and to direct people where to find it if that seems useful.
Great. Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to be able to direct people there. And would you be able to give us a quick experience of that now, or Is there more? We can go there and we can get an experience of it from that resource.
I think it's, I'm just looking at our time, and I think what might be, I don't feel like I have time to do it justice right now, and I have something else in mind, an experience that I'd like to offer people that kind of helps understand this process of change. So are you open to that? A little bit different experience,
definitely.
And then if people want to try on this centering practice, they can get a hold of the Stress the Serenity Guide because that's already out there. Okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So I said before that we have a tendency to kind of beat ourselves up for the places where we're stuck. And we tend to get a lot of good ideas about how to change, or we don't have any idea how to change. But either way, we feel like it's some failing of ours or something bad or wrong about us. And really, in the vast majority of cases, that is just a wrong way of thinking. It's actually just that we've embodied something that was at one time intelligent that's now not working for us anymore. It doesn't match our current or our desired future circumstances. So let's do kind of an experience of what it's like to be in that fight, and then an experience of what it's like to approach it from a different angle. So I'm going to walk you through this, Joel, and I invite anyone who's listening to the recording to do this along with us. Very interesting exercise. So go ahead, Joel, and just make a fist with one of your hands. Mm-hmm. And hold that fist really, 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 really tight. Now, imagine that this fist represents your stuck spot, right? In Jonathan's case, I don't speak up in meetings. Take your other hand and try and peel your fingers apart. Just notice what happens when you try and, with your open hand, you try and open or unpeel your fist. So what's happening for you as you do that?
It's like very difficult. I can't open my hand, and it's almost getting tighter. And then my other hand that's trying to open it is also getting tight and tired.
Yeah. So everything is tightening up around that resistance, around that very well-intentioned desire to open the fist. And you want to open the fist so badly, but actually the approach of pushing or pulling or demanding change of the fist actually just locks it down even tighter. So keep your fist nice and tight. And take your open hand and fill your heart with a sense of love and appreciation and care. Fill your heart with a sense of whatever this fist did, even if I don't understand it, it must have been smart. It had to have been a good idea at one time. And then imagine from your heart going out to your open hand, not to your fist, but out to your open hand, that sense of love and care. And with your open hand, just cradle your fist. Cradle that tight fist and give it a little bit of love and care. What's happening now, Joel?
It's softening and it feels cared for. It's kind of wanting to unfold and relax and open.
Yeah, in my hand, I can feel like those fingers that were holding so tight that whole time we were talking, I was like, oh, there's almost a sense of relief, like, oh, I can let go a little bit now. Yeah.
Cool.
So this is what it is to approach change with love. To approach change with love and appreciation. I want to credit Stacey Haynes at the Strozzi Institute for teaching me that very, very powerful, simple practice. I think it is
love that.
A beautiful illustration of what's possible when we have a genuine appreciation and self-love and can get into an experience of where we've very innocently gotten stuck, and an experience of where else or what else might be possible for us. And it is in the juxtaposition of those two experiences in a very, very loving and caring way that change actually happens, and that durable, ultimately effortless change can take place.
Well, Amanda, thank you very much. It feels like a beautiful place to bring this exploration to a close. And I am deeply grateful of the way that you've shared your wisdom and experience today. I think you've kind of laid out very clearly and succinctly this approach to change that we can take as coaches, and it feels very rigorous, and I'm in full resonance with it. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me to be part of this program. It's really a pleasure and a privilege. So thank you.
And where can we find out more about what you do and you know, the Stress to Serenity challenge? And
great. Yeah. All of my work has an online home at mbright.org, and I'll spell it because it's a funny word and sometimes it needs to be spelled. It's EMBRIGHT, mbright. It's an old, kind of an ancient word that means to brighten. And so mbright.org is where you can find me. And the Stress to Serenity Guide, when you get to the website, you can find under the free tab, you'll find the Stress to Serenity Guide. Or you can go to mbright.org/centering-challenge. That will take you directly to the Stress to Serenity Guide if you want to go directly there.
Well, great, thank you, and I can heartily recommend that people check that out. I've been using it, and it's really great. So, I want to thank you, the listeners, for listening in and giving your time in service of growing your capacity to serve your clients as well. So, thanks for doing that, and please tune into the other series, the other interviews in this series. And have a wonderful day. So, thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this session. If you want to hear more and are not already registered, then you can access the other sessions for free at coachesrising.com/landing/neuroscienceofchange.